This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane. Here are some things you should not say to a friend who is ill or dealing with a difficult diagnosis. Everything happens for a reason. Maybe it happened for the best. You are so brave. You're so inspiring. Chin up. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. These are taken from Letty Cotton Pogrebin's new book, How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who is Sick. It's based in part on what she learned when she was told in 2009 that she had breast cancer. She also interviewed fellow patients about what they wanted their friends to say and do. And since you and I and our friends are going to face illness, losses, and or difficult diagnoses, we invited Letty Cotton Pogrebin to join us on Radio Times. She's a founding editor of Ms. Magazine, the author of 10 books, also co-founder of a number of organizations, including the National Women's Political Caucus and the Ms. Foundation for Women. And Letty Cotton Pogrebin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You wrote this book after you got this diagnosis of breast cancer. First of all, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing very well, thank you. I've been proclaimed a survivor.
And what does it feel to be proclaimed a survivor?
You just stop thinking about it. You sort of feel you're back at square one where everybody else is who hasn't had a mammogram a minute ago. You know, you can never say you're cancer-free unless you've just come out of your mammogram.
And did this book come from the fact that when you got this diagnosis, and you did tell some friends, is that you realized that some people really handled this very well and perhaps handled you very well, and others were just clueless?
That's what inspired the writing of the book. I decided to tell my 12 closest friends, which may sound sort of like a non sequitur to have 12 closest friends, but I did.
Good for you.
I narrowed it down, and I told them exactly what happened, and then I asked them not to tell anybody. And 3 days later, I got a call from somebody outside that circle, very lovely person, saying, "How are you? What can I do for you?" All the right things, but not someone I had chosen to confide in. And a day after that, email, and then more email, and more phone calls, and a get well card. And suddenly my diagnosis had metastasized, in gossip terms. And I was very unhappy about having to keep revisiting my diagnosis and how I found it and how I felt and so on. And so it started to kind of occur to me that the illness etiquette we all grew up with, it's not very helpful in real life. The constant contact, the fact that people tell other people, you know, because they feel as if they have to get it off their chest, it suddenly becomes their problem that you're sick. And when I was in the waiting room at Sloan Kettering for radiation treatments, and let me say, what sick people do more than anything else is wait.
Mm.
I was thinking about the fact that I had some friends who had just pitch-perfect responses, and some who just did the wrong thing or, as you said something totally unbelievably awful. And one friend who, after I had told her my diagnosis, I never heard another word from her, though
just
I saw
her. Just kind of
disappeared? This one didn't disappear, but she simply never made reference to it, and I saw her about 3 or 4 times a month. So I'm sitting in the waiting room thinking, I ought to read a book about friendship and illness because I'm not doing well with it. And I'm not content with how my friends are, and I don't know what I should say to them besides what they're obviously awkward about saying to me. And I said, look, let me check my BlackBerry. Looked and looked in Amazon, and there wasn't a book I wanted to read. So I said, I have to write one.
So what did you, I mean, in hindsight, and in many ways, this is what your book is about, but what did you want your friends to say to you? Mm. And you talk about something called compassion etiquette. And it sounds like you wanted to be honest, and you wanted your friends to be honest.
That's the bottom line. That's the starting gate. I can't emphasize that any more than to say it as strongly as possible that from the very get-go, from the moment you get a diagnosis, if you're the sick person, or from the moment you hear it from a friend, you need to establish kind of guidelines. Mm-hmm. And it gets real easy if you say to each other, we're going to just tell it like it is here. We're not going to pretend. I'm not going to pretend that it's okay for you to come over because I'm tired. I don't really want you to come over right now, and I have to feel okay to tell you that. So you establish a guideline that allows anything to be said. What you've just said to me is annoying. When you put your feet up on the hospital bed, it's annoying. When you sit close to me and you've just had a garlic pizza, it's annoying, you know. Or You know, please don't drop by. I don't feel comfortable feeling that my door is open at this point. Now, these are counterintuitive because supposedly, you know, the Woody Allen policy holds firm, which is 85% is showing up. And people do kind of counsel you, just show up.
Right.
Don't ask
right.
the sick person. Don't bother them with questions about, you know, how they feel or what they want. Just show up. In my experience, in the experience of my husband who had hip surgery, in the experience of most of the 80 people I ended up interviewing in that waiting room when I decided to write the book, I realized that right around me every day a different group of patients were sitting there available to me, and I just went over to them. I said, I'm a journalist. I'm writing a book about friendship and illness. Would you let me know what was helpful and what wasn't?
Well, what's interesting, and it makes a lot of sense, is that as the patient or the sick person, obviously there are things that you need that are different from a relationship between two healthy people.
Yeah.
Did you also want your friends to be honest with you, to say, you know what?
Absolutely.
I'm thinking of all the potentially, you know, negative or maybe even hurtful things that could be said to
yeah,
somebody.
Yeah. I think that it has to be a two-way street. And I counsel in the book that the friend of the sick person should be able to say the following three sentences. Tell me what's helpful and what's not.
Right.
Tell me when you want to be alone and when you want company. And tell me what to bring and what and when to leave. Because all of those issues are potential kind of flashpoints, areas that can become uncomfortable for the sick person, also uncomfortable for the well person who feels awkward and who is almost as uncomfortable in the situation because of not knowing what to say and not knowing what to do and sort of having to pick up on signals without having first had that conversation about let's be honest.
I was quoting from your book in my introduction about what not to say. You do include some people who got it right, including saying things like, I'm so sorry this happened to you. Tell me how I can help. I'm here if you want to talk. Just give me marching orders. These are very simple, kind of uncomplicated things to say to somebody.
Yeah,
but it feels so fraught.
It wouldn't be fraught if we really accepted that what we want to say is what we should say. What we want to say is, I feel so terrible. What we want to say is, I hope you're not in pain. What we want to say is, you know, tell me what I can do, and I really mean it, because I know everybody says, tell me what I can do, and a lot of people disappear. So you need to underline it. You need to underscore it with, I really mean it. If I hear somebody say, call me if you need me, I don't believe that for a minute. But if someone says, call me if you need me, I want to be here for you, and I don't know how to do it, so please help me. Please be honest. Please tell me what you need.
The very first question I put to you is, you know, how are you feeling? But you also write in this book, which is actually a better question to ask someone, is what are you feeling?
Yes.
Not
what,
how are you
no,
feeling?
No, because how are you? I talk about three things that are problematic that almost everybody says. One is, how are you? It's basic human discourse
sure.
to start a conversation with how are you. But in a second, I'll kind of spin out how difficult it can be to answer that question. The second thing that people seem to say when they first hear that you're sick is, oh, my God. That oh, my God reaction, which telegraphs a sense of tragedy, a sense of doom. People need to take a beat and need to think to themselves, how's this going to sound? Not just blurt out because you're nervous or you're shocked. Take a beat and say, what's this going to sound like? Would I like to hear, oh, my God? Or, oh, my God, my friend just died of that. People just say
people
those
say
things.
That.
People say those things. And the third thing is that's annoying or problematic is you look great because we don't believe it. And therefore, whatever else you say, we may not believe. You look great. If you say it to a person on an ordinary, everyday basis, say it. But if you're not into remarking constantly on how your friend looks, don't say it because it's suspicious and it gives us a kind of opposite sense. Now, just to go back to how are you, because it's so, again, counterintuitive that how are you is problematic. What else do you say to a person when you first see them?
Of course.
The best thing people wanted to hear was, it's good to see you.
It's good to see you.
That's what they wanted to hear. Because if they hear how are you, very often it comes across with a kind of portentous tone and what's called the Irish wake shake. You know, they grab you and they say, how are you? And, of course, if you say fine, they say, no, I mean really. And you have to go back and visit the most discomforting part of your experience. You have to go back and say, well, I'm actually coming out of chemo, or, well, I've just been told that my diagnosis is even worse than I thought. They have to go back to their original diagnosis and how they felt so vulnerable. The how are you, if you're going to answer it truthfully, is not something people want to really sit still and hear. Unless they can say, how are you? I really care. I really want to know. And then that you have time to listen, because it's so commonplace for us to say, how are you? Fine, and move on. Or how are you? Great. Things are great. Go and move on. We don't really listen for the intonation that might suggest there's more problem. And when a person is sick, they don't know whether to trouble you with their story.
Well, you know, reading your book and even hearing your talk, hearing you talk about what you and others that you interviewed, what you want the rest of us to do and say, it does sound like when you hear that a friend is sick, you sort of project onto them. I mean, you perhaps even over-identify with them. So it becomes about you and your anxiety and not your friend who's having a difficult time or dealing with a difficult diagnosis. Right.
I think that's the origin of the difficulty and awkwardness. You know, we're ill at ease around illness because it's coming close to us. And
it could be me.
Could be me. It's either there, but for the grace of God go I, which is a little bit of a distancing thing, or this could be me because this is my friend and we went to school together, or we're more or less the same age, or we both run together and play tennis together. Why is this happening? And if it's happening to him, it could be happening to me. So there is a kind of existential overlay here, a fear and a sense of mortality coming too close.
Well, especially with a good friend who you probably shared, you know, so many experiences and interests.
Yes.
So there's a natural kind of identification
with
that person.
Total identification. The hardest of those situations is the one where your friend has a sick child, and a very sick child, or a dying child, or a child who has died. People absolutely go deaf and dumb when that happens. They don't want to hear it, and they don't want to say anything. They're sure they're going to put their foot in their mouth, and they probably are. So my chapter on As Bad As It Gets, how to deal with parents, friends of yours who are parents of a sick child, I think that was where I learned the most. Interviewing parents whose children were sick, or whose kids had committed suicide, or a parent of a child who had drowned in the family pool. I mean, that's tough.
Sure is. I want to pick up on that after this very short break. Letty Cotton Pogrebin, our guest, How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who is Sick. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Questions, comments, stories, give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AT&T Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, It's My Party, the Women in Comedy Project, a world premiere comedy written and directed by Jennifer Childs. Featuring an eclectic cast of Philadelphia actresses, It's My Party, the Women and Comedy Project dives into the many roles comedy plays in women's lives, exploring and exposing the real comedy of everyday life. Tickets and information at 1812productions.org.
I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Have you made a pledge of support to WHYY yet? We're in the middle of the spring membership drive, and as soon as we reach our goal, we will end this campaign. We can only do it if you call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. You're listening to Where Your Money Goes to support programs like Radio Times. We bring you regional, national, and international news and analysis, and we keep you informed about the important issues of the day. We also also introduce you to interesting people and ideas. We believe you're the kind of person who wants that kind of programming. So if you have never made a pledge or you have let your membership lapse, now is the time to take that step and become a listener supporter. You'll be happy you did. Here's that phone number again. It's 1-888-345-9499. Again, you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Whatever you can afford, take that next step, and we thank you in advance. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. And again, our guest is Letty Cotton Pogrebin, and her book is, called How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who is Sick. Picking up on where we left off right before the break, you have 10 rules for friends of a bereaved parent. And as you mentioned, and I 100% agree with you, that when a parent loses a child, and there's so many different ways you could lose a child, that's just a heartbreak.
It is, I think, the most difficult encounter that you have as a friend is visiting, being available to, knowing how to speak to, knowing how to physically relate to a parent whose child is very ill, fatally, or very sick, or has died. Mm. And from my interviews, thank God I've never had that experience. It's the worst, the most tragic, the most unimaginable. But from interviews, I've learned that people want to be able to set the tone. That's most important. They don't want you to come in with a lot of flurrying of attempts to comfort. They want to set the tone. Sometimes they want to talk and sometimes they want to be silent. You can reach out physically. You can offer a hug. But if you sense that they're tensing up, don't do that again. You can pay attention to how they relate to other people who are coming to visit and get your cues from that. You require a heightened consciousness to the point where you can start to really decode what this person needs or ask them, point blank, please, I'm here all day if you want me. But if you want some time alone, I'm perfectly comfortable sitting outside or going home. Tell me when to come back. Offer a whole set of options that will allow the person to make the choice and not to have to feel they have to take care of you. Very often we put that burden on the person who's suffering. This is not a sick friend. This is a friend who's sick at heart.
Indeed.
And that requires, as I say, a kind of sensitivity that ordinary friendship doesn't. When you're sitting around with someone watching a game together or having coffee, you don't need to tune in to that degree, but you do hear.
You use the word silent, and it's an interesting, it comes up in a number of these chapters, the idea that when you're with someone who is sick, to be comfortable with the silence. You don't have to fill this time with talk.
This was the biggest lesson for me personally because I'm a talker and also I'm a problem solver, so it doesn't come naturally to realize that sometimes just being with the person, allowing comfort in silence, just holding a hand, making a cup of tea for them, but that's all I have to give. That's all I should be giving. That's all they want right now. They don't want chatter. They don't want me to suggest that they should take this nutrient or that supplement, which people do, you know. And let me say one more thing about the parent dealing with parents who've lost a child.
Sure.
Because I think listeners need to know this more than almost anything else. They want to talk about their child. Mostly when we relate to people who have lost a child, we don't mention the child as if our mention is going to make them sadder. They can't get any sadder. We don't have the power to make them any sadder, just like we don't have the power to say anything that's going to make them feel any better. So the thing to do is offer, as when you go to the funeral or you go to the visit, the condolence visit, you know, you say how you feel. I feel so awful. I'm so, so sorry. You say your sympathy. Sympathy means suffering with. You say your sympathy. But then you offer something of the child.
So I remember when he was...
Right. I remember when he ran in that race and, you know, came in second and was just so excited about it. Mm-hmm. You would have thought he came in first.
A great laugh.
Yeah, exactly. Something that tells the parent, I will always remember your child. Your child is going to be real to me, not like you, but in my small way. And that's the only thing that people said was comforting to them. They didn't want their children blotted out.
You have a chapter about visiting someone in the hospital and, you know, the sort of cliched, I guess, present, which would be the flowers or the candy, something like the balloons. Think a little more creatively, I guess, when visiting, but also when you think about what you might want to bring to the hospital.
Yeah. Well, I do have a chapter on giving good gifts.
Good
visits,
good gifts.
And gifts that go wrong. I tell the story in the book about a friend of mine who had a breast cancer operation. And I just knew that she would be weak and kind of, logy for a while. So I had the bright idea of ordering a week's worth of meals for her. I knew she was kosher, so I made sure there was no pig products and no shellfish. Healthy things, 7 meals packed in dry ice, beautifully packed. And I had it sent to her house the day she came home from the hospital. That afternoon she called and said it was just a beautiful presentation. The basket is gorgeous. The napkins came with little glasses. It's just great. And I knew she didn't say a word about the food.
Right.
So I'm thinking to myself, well, maybe it's because it's 4 o'clock. She hasn't eaten yet. And then about a month later, I met her and her husband in the lobby of Lincoln Center. And I said, I was wondering, how is the food? Because it's the business of a friend of mine. I just want to make sure the food's good. And she said, well, actually, in all honesty, we couldn't eat it. I said, you couldn't eat it? She said, we're glatt kosher. Glatt kosher is like a step
glucose
beyond kosher.
Oh,
you need to have an authority come in and kosher your kitchen to be glatt kosher. And my friend, who packed all these healthy meals, she's not glatt kosher. So my friend, the sick person, said, don't worry about it, Letty. We gave the food to the homeless shelter, and they loved it. And I love the basket and the napkins.
Do your homework, right,
yes.
I guess.
Exactly. You have to think harder about who is this and what would they like? Is it somebody who is the type who would sit in bed in a bed jacket because they're confined to their bed for a long time?
Right.
Somebody who would like to feel elegant like that, or somebody who would prefer flannel pajamas? Who is this person? Not to bring yet another bouquet, which when you get there, half of them are dead in their hospital room anyway. And I have to say the best gift I heard about was marijuana. Somebody gave
who was the recipient?
A person who had a really serious form of cancer that did not allow his appetite to operate, and he couldn't sleep. And in New York State, marijuana is not legal for the treatment, medical marijuana. And this person took the risk of bringing marijuana because he said to himself, this is more important to me, that my friend get relief, that my friend can eat and sleep. I'll take the rap, whatever it is. And he made a connection and he brought grass to this person. And while I was writing about this, there was an article on the op-ed page of the New York Times by a judge who had the same kind of cancer who said, my friends bring me marijuana. And though I'm a judge, and though I could actually have them arrested, they are giving me the best gift I could possibly wish for.
I was thinking, I can't top that, but I was thinking when I have had friends who have needed some care and feeding, often buying just those trashy magazines,
yeah. That's a great thing.
Just so you can read all the sort of phony gossip that's
and
out there.
And people say to me, instead of bringing these gourmet packaged things that I'm not going to eat, the candy and so on and the jellied fruits, bring me lamb chops. Bring me something normal that I can put in my fridge and feel like a normal person. What sick people want above all else is to be normalized.
Mm. Let me reintroduce you. That's Letty Cotton Pogrebin, and the book is called How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who is Sick. And she's a founding editor of Ms. Magazine. She's written a number of other books as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Looks like we are getting our phone calls lined up, and I will take them as soon as they are. I'm also wondering about that person in the hospital. Just wanting to be touched, touched in a not a sexual way, but in a friendly, intimate kind of way.
Yeah, well, there are gender differences on that one,
yes,
as there are on many, many issues I deal with in the book. You have to know your friend very well to know how likely he or she will be to enjoy a foot rub. But that's one of the great gifts. People love anything that gives them pleasure. Pleasure is the one thing that you really miss when you're sick. You have rare opportunities.
Sensual pleasure, right?
Yes. If the person, give a person a certificate for a massage, that would be so much more appreciated than a plant, you know, if you're feeling lousy. And by the same token, a hug will feel good to some people. And to others, it will feel intrusive and nervy and, you know, discomforting. For a lot of people, just sitting and holding a hand, if a person is tired and you're tired of speaking,
sure,
just a handhold will feel good. To other people, it'll feel like, you know, who does she think she is? You know, it will feel condescending or patronizing. You have to bring that level of consciousness to bear where you don't just behave the way people are supposed to when they're dealing with a sick person. You behave the way this person that you know, that you supposedly know, would want you to.
They're not a baby. Yeah. I mean, that's one thing that you say. And tone is so important, where the words can feel right, but the tone can be off.
How about the way that people infantilize sick folks? I heard about things like one fully grown person saying to a fully grown patient, "Do you think you can go wee-wee now?"
Oh, no. Really?
Yes, really. Really. Or we need to take our pills now.
Oh, our pills.
Our pills. I mean, you're talking to a 6-year-old, 4-year-old. And there's nothing worse than feeling not only powerless and sick, but treated like a baby and losing your dignity.
Let me see what Nancy has to say. Nancy, joining us on Radio Times. Nancy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you so much for this conversation.
You're very welcome.
Well, when my husband was sick, and he subsequently has passed, a lot of people just said, "What can I do to help?" And I have to say that for me and for my husband, we were so stressed. The question, "What can I do to help?" was way too general. And left us with offers of help that I've still never taken up on because I didn't know what to ask. So I think you also need to look deep in your heart as a friend to be able to say, what am I actually able to offer? Can I say, can I go to the store for you? Can I be a chemo buddy and sit with you in the afternoon? So it's not so broad stroke about what somebody needs from you.
Sure, Nancy, I have to say that Letty is nodding her head as you're talking. Go ahead, Letty.
Yes, because my book says this over and over again in so many ways. What can I do for you is really not helpful at all. Call me if you need me is not helpful at all. But if the person doesn't give you that, if you haven't had that honesty conversation and the person doesn't give you guidance, if you had the honesty conversation, the person would say, you know, I'm really worried about my garden. Could you go out and deadhead my marigolds because I'm afraid they'll never come back? If you have not had that honesty conversation, then you need to do exactly what Nancy suggests, to look around, be conscious, and realize, you know what, this younger child is really making too many demands on her while she's sick. I'm going to take that kid for the day. And say, may I take, you know, Johnny for the day because it might give you some free time to be with your husband or be with the older child and create a little less chaos and a little less frenzy around you while you're sick. People are so grateful for free time. Give them free time. Give them peace and serenity. And very often that means bring them food, but coordinate with other friends because sometimes people get 3 casseroles for one night or they fill up their freezer and then there's, you know, wasted food. So if you can organize a few friends to create a circle of dinner makers or people who do the shopping for you or people who take you to chemo, people who sit with you in the waiting room, that's something that you as a friend can coordinate on behalf of your sick friend.
Nancy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Carol has to say. Carol, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi. Thank you for the conversation.
You're welcome.
I'm calling from a different perspective, and I understand you said that this has to be a two-way honesty conversation. I had a sister who was terminally ill for several years and has passed away, but we had a very difficult time. She was my best friend, and we talked about everything. But at some point, with my other sister and I, we got into a thing that it was all my sister wanted to talk about was the illness.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, we wanted to be honest with her to say there are things also going on in our lives. But anytime we would bring up something about us, she would want to trump us and say, well, but I have this illness. And it was very difficult. I'd like to hear from,
sure,
from you what your suggestion is. At this point, it's a moot point, but I think it might be helpful for other people to hear how to say that in a way that is, I certainly wanted to be honest with her, but she was not willing to hear that. It was like, well, you don't understand, and this is what I want to talk about.
Okay.
And I didn't want people to be moving away from her.
Sure. No, I think you raise a really, really good point, and I want to give our guests a chance to respond. And, Carol, thanks for the call to
thank
Radio
you.
Times.
Yeah, thank you, Carol. In talking to people who have had grave illnesses, I discovered that, there are gradations of illness that require different kinds of conversational strategies on the part of friends. I think, in all honesty, if you're dealing with someone who's dying, they need to set the rules mm-hmm. of the conversation. People who are in extremis because either they are dying or someone they love is dying do not want to hear about how your kid scored in a soccer game. It really is offensive, painful, deeply painful. And I think that they trump everything if they're dying. They have to be able to feel that it is all about them, that it's not about you. They're not going to be around to see the life you're living. They're never going to have that again. And it's almost a form of cruelty to impose on somebody. I'll give you an example. My daughter was friends with somebody whose child was dying of brain cancer. And my daughter used to have breakfast with this woman regularly. The breakfast stopped because this woman's whole life was dedicated to taking care of her kid, researching the illness and so on. And my daughter had in her head, how much can we retain our friendship without some give and take? But she realized that if she talked about how she was worried about her son Ben and his math, that's what was foremost in her mind, is that is he going to make it to pass math? And Nancy is worried about how are the steroids going to work? Is this going to be the last chance medicine? It would be such an imbalance. It would be, again, cruel. Now, as I said, there are gradations of illness. What you want with other people who are not on their way to dying, you want to help them get back to normalcy. That's what they want. So talking about other things is extremely important with people who are not in such grave situations.
And we're almost up at a break, and just picking up on that, because I could also see that someone feeling like, well, I don't want to be the dependent person in this relationship.
Yeah.
I want to help you with your problems.
Yes, exactly. You don't want to feel as if you have nothing to offer. And you want to talk, I call it capital O, capital T. You want to talk about other things to keep your link to real life. I hated to be treated like cancer girl. I mean, that was really what I avoided, why I hated the gossip that proliferated immediately after I told my closest friends, because I suddenly saw people looking at me with a different gaze. A little bit of,
poor Letty.
Pity, yeah. And I wanted to talk about capital O, capital T, other things.
Well, we're going to talk about other things after this very short break. Again, Letty Cotton Pogrebin, our guest. The book is How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Westchester University Online Studies. From an accredited MBA to a master's in special education, convenient and flexible degree and certificate programs are available in several subject areas such as business, health, and education. For more information or to submit an application online, wcupa.edu/grad. Westchester University. Learn more.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We run this news service at WHYY on the honor system. If you listen to any of the programs we present, then we thank you for becoming a supporter by making a pledge of support. You know the value of what you hear. That's why you listen. Now take that next step and pay for the service you use. You wouldn't eat a meal and not pay for it when you are finished, so don't be a listener who's not a supporter. Make a pledge right now at 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. What can you afford? $60, $100, $250? You decide, and again, make that call at 1-888-345-9499. We do these membership campaigns just three times a year, about 99% of the rest of the broadcast time. It's the programs you enjoy. Radio Times, Fresh Air, Here and Now, Talk of the Nation, All Things Considered, Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Make a pledge, 1-888-345-9499. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. And if you're just joining us, Liddy Cotton Pogrebin is our guest, a founding editor of Ms. Magazine, co-founder of the National Women's Political Caucus and the Ms. Foundation for Women, author of a number of books, including a new one called How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who is Sick. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Letty and I were talking during the break, or I was asking her about those people who are not your close friends, not that close circle of friends, but the ones just on the periphery of that. And yes, they might be neighbors who you know you've shared a kind of a life with. And I think that sometimes maybe requires different kinds of ways of being and acting.
Yes, I think we all have concentric circles of friendship, the intimate inner circle with our family and friends, and then neighbors, colleagues, acquaintances, people you see at meetings, and then, people you just kind of wave to.
Yeah.
I think the important thing to realize is that the more people know, the more people are going to ask you how you are. Check in, right, make phone calls. And you need to establish a kind of basic policy about that. And when people call to say, I'm so grateful for your call, but I just don't really want to go back to my illness because I'm really trying to get beyond it. And I'm in a healing phase. So thank you so much for calling. But
right,
I really don't want to talk about it anymore. Whereas with your intimate friends, they're going through it step by step, this test and this medicine and this pain. They're with you. The other ones, you don't want to report in, This is why I regret that, actually, that I didn't tell way more than 12. I wish I had gone to my outermost circle,
really?
Because then I could have put out a mass email, and then I could have said, here's how I am, and here's where I am in the process, and thank you very much for your concern, but I'm ready to put this behind me. Mass email. I wouldn't have to do it one by one.
Let me see what that looks like. Seely from Bethlehem has to say. Seely, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Both of my children were diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and they had serious cases of bipolar disorder. Both of my children, at different ages, committed suicide.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Sally.
They were my only children, and most of my friends backed away from me.
Yes.
Very few stuck with me. This happened over a 20-year period where my youngest son was diagnosed when he was 15. He committed suicide when he was 23.
Mm-hmm.
My older son was about 20 when he was diagnosed, and he committed suicide when he was 36.
Uh-huh.
So I would like to see, and it just hurt me that my friends backed away.
Yes.
And I don't know if it was out of fear, out of ignorance. I just don't know.
Right.
Because
see,
I haven't thought.
Sure. And obviously, we're so sorry to hear what happened to you and your sons. Obviously, extremely difficult situation. But looking back, what would you have liked your friends to do or say?
An occasional phone call saying, hey, I'm just checking in with you. I'm calling to see how you are, how your husband is, and how your son is doing, or your sons.
Mm-hmm.
How can I help you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had even, asked people to reach out to my children because at one point my older son was really isolated himself.
Mm-hmm.
And for years he isolated himself. And I was begging people to reach out to him, even by email.
Mm-hmm.
And people didn't even do that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that. Let me see what Letty has to say.
Yeah, thank God I haven't had this experience, and I'm so sorry that you did. But I interviewed for parents of children who committed suicide. And I was saying to Marty before the show that after some of my interviews, I really needed like a few days to recover because it so deeply affected me. And what they said was people treated them as if it was contagious, that somehow or other that being near me or even talking to me about it was going to rub off on them. They also said, I simply don't know what to say or do. This is too horrible, and therefore I'm not going to do anything, and I'm going to disappear. It's a kind of me-first attitude, which is really unfortunate, but people are so deeply threatened by this. This goes to the core of powerlessness, pain, tragedy, and people want to get as far away as they can. This didn't have anything to do with you or your sons. It's the situation.
Sure.
I spoke to a woman who's, I spoke to Judy Collins, who happens to be a friend of mine, the folk singer, and so I had a lot of time to talk to her about her son Clark, who committed suicide. I think he was in his 30s, and he had become sober, and he had gotten control of his life, and then there was one disappointment, and he couldn't handle it. I don't know if it was bipolar or what the mental situation was, and he got into the car and turned on the motor and died. Mm. And Judy said that she speaks a lot about suicide, and that you cannot, number one, blame yourself, number two, think you could have avoided this or done anything to prevent it, and number three, that you have to tell your friends not to be afraid to talk to you about it, not to be afraid to say, how did it happen? How did you feel? Because, again, your silence is not going to help them suffer less. Mm-hmm. So you may as well be honest with them that you're concerned about them, worried about how they're recovering and how they're repairing their feelings. And Judy tries to talk about it like at a dinner party. People will say, how old's your kid? You know, well, my kid's going to college, and how's your kid, and where's your kid, and so on. And Judy says, unfortunately, my son committed suicide. And everyone goes, and nobody knows what to say. And she says right out, I'm happy to talk about it to anybody who needs advice, but we don't have to talk about it at this dinner party.
Celia, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And she did use the word fear. It's sort of wondering, were people afraid? And the kind of illusion, I think, that, you know, we have about being a parent, that you can protect your child from all these things. And it's just isn't so, especially when they become adults.
Yes, and people relate to the parent as if you must have done something to cause this, which is a horrible feeling and has no basis in reality. But so the parent feels blame from their friends rather than support and love.
Celia, again, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Letty Cotton Pogrebin about her book, How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who's Sick. I'm also, though, thinking, and these are some people that I have known in my life that really are very private. And they're not suffering in silence. It's just the way that they sort of do their life. It's the way they deal with issues that might be troublesome to them. And the impulse is to sort of break through to that silence and talk to them. But it's not necessarily what they want.
This is, again, it comes back to taking the temperature of your individual friend and their situation. If that person is private about illness, they've probably been private about their marriage. They've been private about their sex life. They've probably been private about how much money they make. That's the sort of people they are. So with those people, you don't push. You don't press. You don't intrude on them. You respect it. As I say, when you're in a regular friendship, these thoughts don't have to go through your head. What does he need? What's her, you know, sort of stumbling block in this? What personality trait can I kind of plug into here in order to be most helpful? When we talk about private, we also have to talk about shame. The people who have certain kinds of illnesses are ashamed and don't want to talk about them because they feel it will make them look weak, mostly in the case of men. The gender difference is key here. They're afraid that if their bosses find out, they'll be fired. In the case of men, they feel emasculated by illness. in the case of women, they may be ashamed of something reproductive that's happening to them or physical that's happening to them. Certainly in the case of children who are having problems, people don't want to talk about it because you'll think badly of them as parents. So you have to respect that, but at the same time, make your availability so clearly known. You know, if you want to kind of keep this to yourself, it's fine, but I just want you to know that I'm here as a listener. I'm not going to do anything or, you know, make things better by myself. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychologist. I'm here as a listener, and I'm here to do whatever will help you feel better. But if silence is good, silence is good for me, too.
Let's see what Daniel from Willow Grove has to say. Daniel, go ahead. You're in Radio Times.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm a Hodgkin survivor and a pastor, so I deal a good bit with these situations. And one of the things I was listening to early on and made me think about was some of the power differentials that develop, social power differentials. And then with the one caller talking about being abandoned by friends, it occurred to me that oftentimes could play a large part in it, is as people see that the sick person does oftentimes is given, you know, to set the agenda, and therefore in many ways has more power and social power, and people kind of avoid that. And so how do we develop a better sense of balance? And I appreciated the trust as a major issue, but there's so many other issues where we just have to come to some kind of balance in power.
Yeah. It's a great call, Daniel. Yeah. I appreciate it. Go ahead.
Yeah, man. It's a great call. I think the imbalance in power is a very interesting issue, but when you look at it, the crux of it is that the healthy person comes in with vibrant cheeks. Maybe they're wearing their yoga clothes, their sneakers, and the sick person is in bed and is wan and, you know, yellow and has tubes coming out of all their orifices. The power balance there is so clearly in favor of the healthy person. So though I understand what you're saying, that sometimes because they are sick, they have the power to control you, to make you feel guilty, to set the agenda in a way that's not convivial. I understand that. But in most cases, it's the healthy person who has to be really careful not to, for instance, stand above the bed, get a chair, be on an equal level. The person who's dealing with someone with disabilities, in, say in a wheelchair, get down there so they don't have to always crane their neck. That kind of sensitivity to power imbalances that are either permanent in the case of, for instance, chronic illness. When we're dealing with somebody who is not going to get better, we're ill-equipped. We have in our mind a kind of trajectory, a linear sense. People get sick, they get treated, they get better. It's very hard for us to accept that there are some people who are never getting better. Blind people are always going to be blind. People paraplegics are always going to be paraplegics. People with ALS are going to probably get worse, not better. And again, that's something where sensitivity to the fact that you are the, quote, healthy or the whole person, you're not better. You just happen to not have those things that your friend has. You have to really, really bring so much sensitivity to bear to not sort of even unconsciously seem to be lording it over the person who is, in fact, weaker.
And literally by standing over their bed, physically standing over their bed. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Letty Cotton Pogrebin. The book is called How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who is Sick, a founding editor of Ms. Magazine. I'm Marty Moskowain, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get, looks like Carolyn from King of Prussia to join us. Carolyn, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I wanted to just address the issue of people abandoning us when we really need them. And because I was also in a situation where my child was very, you know, terribly injured in an accident. Mm. And many people were around for me, but a lot of people weren't. And I think it's just so difficult for people to relate. It's so scary. They feel it is contagious. Your misfortune might become theirs, and they can't possibly imagine being in your shoes, and they just don't know how to relate to us. They're afraid to do the wrong thing. They're afraid to say the wrong thing.
Imagine if they just said to you,
right. Go ahead.
Exactly, just said to you, I don't know what to say. This is so terrible. I feel so bad for you. That opens the gates to And they don't have to feel awkward anymore. Right. You don't have to worry about them because they've been honest with you. And then you can say, you know, most people are just not relating to us normally anymore. I interviewed somebody whose child died of asthma at the age of 9, a Jewish woman who said some people didn't come to the Shiva, the 7 days of mourning. And some people to this day, it's 30 years later, have never mentioned the child, as if somehow or other that even the mention of the child would afflict their children with asthma.
Carolyn, let me just ask you a question. Based on what Letty just said, would that be helpful if someone were to say to you, I'm just at a loss for words. I feel, you know, all the things that she said. Would that have been helpful?
Yes, and some people did do that, and it was helpful.
Yeah, and then you can guide them, and then you can react, and then you can actually share your feelings because the person has said, you know, I don't know what to say, but I'm here for you. Instead of being so afraid that they have to stay away from you because they might say the wrong thing. That's
Carolyn,
counterproductive.
Yeah. Indeed it is. Carolyn, thank you so much for calling into Radio Times. You're very welcome, and we're almost out of time here, Letty, So you used the word cancer girl when you were going through your treatment. So what kind of girl are you now?
Well, since I've stopped people from asking me how I am, I just say, you know, fine, done, been there, done that, finished. I'm fine because I don't have to go back there. I will, when somebody has a new diagnosis herself, I will go back there. I will let myself go back to the horrible part of when you first find out, and I will provide as much reassurance and information more than anything else, how it feels to get a lumpectomy, to look at your scar, to have, you know, radiation and worry about a burned chest. I'll get very specific with someone who's going through it, but I don't want to talk about it to anybody who just says, how are you, or what was it like?
Well, on that note, my thanks to you for joining us today on Radio Times. Again, Letty Cotton Pogrebin, our guest. The last name spelled P-O-G-R-E-B-I-N. And the book is titled How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who Is Sick. Who's sick? Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. And you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, and everything like that. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.